Move on at last away from electricity to Ortiz versus Werner Enterprises. Ms. Temple.
May it please the court, Nancy Temple for Appellant Henry Ortiz. It's our position there are material issues of disputed fact that require the reversal of grant of summary judgment in this Title VII termination case, both under the indirect and the direct methods. As this court has noted, those methods do overlap. Under the indirect
Can you
method,
speak a little louder?
Under the indirect method, Mr. Ortiz, the evidence shows he met the legitimate expectations of his employer. There was no dispute of an adverse employment action. He was terminated in June 2012, and the similarly situated comparators were treated more favorably. The white brokers did the exact same things that Ortiz was allegedly terminated for, and none of them were terminated, and none of them were disciplined.
I assume you mean their employment was terminated.
Correct. Yes,
his employment was terminated. Still healthy.
He is still alive and healthy, yes, sir. The evidence of the similarly situated comparators, the white brokers, and Ortiz was Hispanic, is also relevant to the issue of pretext. And there's other evidence of pretext as well. It overlaps with the direct method. The pretext is relevant to the direct method. The direct method also shows we presented multiple evidence from Mr. Ortiz that throughout the tenure of his 7-year employment history and leading right up until the week before his
Counsel,
termination.
As far as I can see, this case turns on an understanding of how these particular loss loads got assigned to your client. Your brief describes these as irregular assignments that were obviously done to set up or cause losses to Ortiz. And the employer says these were assigned in the ordinary way. And these are perfectly, you know, some losses, some gains, they're all assigned in an ordinary way. And neither side tries to explain to us why its view of this evidence is the right one. So would you explain to us why, in your view, these were irregular assignments, or in what sense they were irregular?
Yes, Judge. They occurred on June 6 and June 7, 2012, within a 24-hour period. The first one in the morning of June 6.
No. Would you kindly explain in what sense they were irregular?
They were irregular because
What Werner says is that this happens all the time. Basically, as I read their brief, they're saying our computer just used its normal algorithm and assigned these things. You obviously disagree. I want to know why you disagree.
In Ortiz's declaration, he explains that on the screen, there's a bunch of loads that say loads need brokering. Everybody has access to that screen. When somebody decides to broker a particular load and book a load, that's what happened to these six loads. Ortiz did not book them in his name. Somebody else did.
Yes.
That is unusual.
Look, I'm well aware of that, and Werner says this is normal behavior, and these loads were assigned to Ortiz under their normal protocol. Now, why is that false?
That is false because the normal procedure is that written notice is given to the particular broker, here Ortiz, when an order is booked in that broker's name by somebody else. Ortiz's declaration, which the district court did not take into account, stated that in 2012, his manager Lass had reprimanded him for booking a load in broker Painter's region, but not notifying or not giving written notice to Painter. His declaration says it was normal practice. Krikova, the assistant manager, Brigham, another white broker, all testified that it was expected practice that a broker would be given written notice if another person was going to book a load in that broker's name. there's no dispute that Ortiz got no notice. There's no written email on the Chicago brokers at Werner.com, common email exchange. There's no document showing that Ortiz had any notice. In fact, the timing and how these were actually booked on June 6th and June 7th show that Ortiz could not have gotten notice. The first one on June 6th, which is Exhibit S, ending 647, Krikova assigned himself as a broker and did not put Ortiz's name as a broker until 5 hours after the load was delivered, giving Ortiz no opportunity to try to negotiate a lower rate. Krikova testified that Ortiz was an amazing freight negotiator, but at no time did he ever try to consult with or talk to or email Ortiz and say, help me out. Can you negotiate a lower rate? Instead, he unilaterally booked these huge, enormous losses for the company that were not in the company's best interest.
Ortiz also unusual in the sense that after plaintiff became aware of these losses being booked under his responsibility, at least according to plaintiff's testimony, he confronted Krikova, and Krikova refused essentially to explain. And when he tried, and then when plaintiff tried to explain in his termination meeting, nobody, Lass didn't want to hear it.
That's correct, Your Honor. Krikova, Lass was on vacation that week of June 4th.
Mm-hmm.
Ortiz found out on Friday, June 8th, and Krikova's testimony has a lot of discrepancies. He said that Ortiz had changed a bunch of these loads during that week of June 4th, but the record shows that only one load was changed on the, late in the afternoon of June 8th by Ortiz. The others happened the following week on June 11th. But Ortiz went to Krikova and said, you know, what's going on, Krikova? You didn't give me notice. Why are you booking these huge losses and not telling me about it? Why are we taking these huge losses? Krikova had no explanation. The only thing he said was, why don't you quit already?
Right.
And then it's true in the termination meeting, there was no follow-up, no questioning, no investigation. And when Ortiz said that the rates were reduced in a discussion with the carrier, because the carrier picked up the load late, his manager, Lass, refused to hear that, refused to address it, and was surprised with that.
Could I ask you a couple of questions? The evidence in this case refers in a number of places to a practice called cyberspacing.
Yes.
That is to taking these the losing loads and apparently trying to shift responsibility into cyberspace. So no individual broker and not even the whole office bore responsibility for them, right? My question is, if you are relying on those things, I would expect there to have been more documentation of loads that had been cyberspaced.
Yes, and we attempted to get that in discovery. Ortiz, as a fired employee, had no access to those records. We don't think that the records produced by IT were complete. We tried to demonstrate that. Ortiz's declaration disputes some of the issues or statements by the IT director, Todd Silence. Silence says there were over 16,000 transactions between June 2001 to December 2012, and that 239 times a broker's name was removed.
So there were no brokers assigned. This was cyberspacing?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And he attempts to explain it as a truck ordered but not used by a customer, but Ortiz's declaration, which was ignored by the district court, says that in a truck ordered not used, the broker's name stays in there because the customer has to pay something then, and the broker wants to have that tracked to get part of that fee and get credit for that. So there are discrepancies in the records produced by Werner there.
Now, regarding the use of language, so he's Puerto Rican, is he?
Yes.
He's not Jewish, is he?
No.
No. Now,
and not Mexican either.
The question I have is, there is such a thing as good-natured abuse, right? When he's called a dumb Jew, my guess is that's a joke, because he's not Jewish. And It's not obvious to me that the other slanderous language is other than the kind of kidding around that you get in all sorts of employment settings. He was there for 7 years, wasn't he?
He was.
So is he actually taking 7 years of ethnic abuse, or is this how they talk to each other?
It intensified in the last 6 months, he testified in his deposition, to more frequency. And we submit that being called a taco eater, a bean eater, a dumb Mexican, dumb Puerto Rican, stupid Puerto Rican on a repeated basis is offensive, and it shows a racial bias. We're not claiming hostile work environment, but it shows an intentional issue that a jury is entitled to decide on credibility. He also testified the reason he didn't complain is someone besides his supervisor last.
Well, what? So he's there for 7 years, and then you say this abusive language becomes more intense. Why does it become more intense?
Ortiz could not answer what was in Lass's head. He said, I don't know why it became more intense. It just did. He didn't like me. But all the evidence, a jury could decide that they wanted to push, Lass wanted to push Ortiz out, either make him quit, and eventually found a reason to, excuse to fire him.
The defense here is not that this was kidding, it's that it didn't happen.
Correct. And it's disputed fact. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Tau. Mr. Reeses?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Reeses, and I'm here today on behalf of Defendant Appellee Werner Enterprise. I want to go to Judge Easterbrook's question about how assignments were made. Before January 1, 2012, you had what was essentially a free-for-all. You had the four brokers who were scrambling to cover the loads that made money. And they didn't want to service the loads that didn't make money. And you didn't need a degree from the University of Chicago in economics to understand the behavior. So the regional system was developed starting January 1, 2012 in the Naperville office to assign specific brokers to specific regions. Mr. Ortiz's region included Texas. All of the loads at issue originated out of Texas. In June, you have what is the growing season. And you have product that has to be shipped from Texas up to Wisconsin or up to Ohio. And because trucks are at a premium, rates go up, which means profits go down and you have losses. But whether you have a profit or a loss, the load has to be brokered. You have to find trucking for the Werner customer to get the load from Texas to wherever it's intended to go. Now, Mr. Ortiz didn't like that system. That's very clear. He said so himself.
Right.
Counsel, and he wasn't yes.
Could you address the evidence of the cyberspacing practice for losing loads, in particular the evidence not only from Mr. Ortiz but also from Taft and Brigham?
Okay. So to begin with, what you're referring to is when a broker takes his name off the load.
So that no broker is assigned.
So that no broker is assigned. And there could be legitimate business reasons for that. Counsel referred to 239 instances out of nearly 17,000.
Right.
Because we produced close to 17,000 loads over an 18-month period. There were legitimate reasons. Let's suppose you're using a Werner truck for a Werner customer. You're not brokering the load through another carrier. Your name comes off. Let's suppose it's shipped by rail. You're not using a truck. You don't get a loss or a profit on a commission. There are specific reasons why.
Right. Why this evidence. I understand you all have explanations, and
yes.
Mr. Silence has his testimony, and we've got other accounts from the folks who actually operated in the system. So why isn't this a question for trial?
Well, Your Honor, they have absolutely no evidence to show that a broker ever had the right to remove his name without permission. That is what is the key here.
Did Krikova have the right to impose a loss on Ortiz without notifying him or at least giving him an explanation?
Yes, he did, because it came out of Texas, okay? And he gets that responsibility whether or not likes it. He doesn't have the option to refuse.
Would you please confront plaintiff's evidence on this point with respect to the practice of giving notice and an opportunity, particularly for the guy who's going to get stuck with the financial responsibility, to try to negotiate a better rate?
Certainly the evidence was that you would try to notify the broker to whom the load was going to be assigned.
That was essentially a universal practice among the brokers?
If you try to email, you try to send a note.
These were all right together when the manager is out.
Yes.
And Krikova and Ortiz are present. Was there some physical barrier to notifying Mr. Ortiz that Krikova was going to dump all these losers on him?
Well, first of all, I take issue with the fact that certainly there were losers, but there were also gains. I mean, he also gave him a gain of 1,000. But to answer your question, he could have emailed him, he could have passed him a note, he could have yelled across the room. Yes, there was
a
practice,
but there
was not a
requirement. And he could have explained when he was confronted about it, correct?
And, yes.
We have to assume that he did not. Well, for purposes of summary judgment, correct?
There's no question that there was a confrontation, Your Honor, but the point is he did not have the right to refuse that load. It was going to be assigned to him whether he liked it or he didn't like it. And by the way, when you're talking about the evidence, look, we produced 17,000 loads. Now, if plaintiff had evidence, okay, specific evidence, not his own opinions and beliefs, but if he had evidence, he could have pulled out the other loads to show that, hey, other brokers were cutting rates. Didn't produce that. Hey, other brokers were removing their name from the load.
Cutting rates, we've got testimony from Rossi, Taft, Ortiz himself, all saying that this was standard operating procedure, management had knowledge of it. We've got all the guys who are still employed by Werner saying, absolutely not, never happens.
By the way,
why isn't that a trial issue?
One, Ross and Tafty were not employed there in 2012. They left in 2010.
They're describing standard practice.
And number two,
is there evidence that the practice changed with respect to changing rates on customers?
There was never a time when you could cut rates. But by the way,
counsel, we're here not from a jury verdict. We're here on summary judgment.
Right.
And one of the things that's very troubling to me about the briefing in this case is the treatment of plaintiff's evidence. Let me shift gears, if I could, for just a moment. We've got evidence that conflicts on changing rates, but let's talk about the ethnic slurs, okay? Because if I look at your brief at page 30, plaintiff's testimony at most suggested that it occurred between 2007 or 2008 and 2010 or 2011. That's the top of your page 30. All right? Are you with me?
Yes.
And you want to treat this all as stray remarks. But, and in the district court, paragraph 43 of your 56.1 statement referred to plaintiff's testimony on direct, as your brief does. What's not cited is what plaintiff testified to in the cross of his deposition, which is what plaintiff was talking about in her argument, which is that these ethnic slurs were continuing and accelerating in frequency up into 2012. And I'm really troubled. And this is by the decision maker, right? Lass.
It is by Lass,
and
yes.
So we've got, it seems to me, a failure to even confront plaintiff's evidence about this.
Your Honor, can I answer that?
Please.
Okay. Number one, and by the way, I do agree that there is a question of fact as to what was said. What plaintiff misses, though, is none of those statements constitute direct evidence. Okay?
The evidence is that these are frequent four or five times a week from the decision maker himself. You think it's unreasonable to permit an inference of ethnic animus on his part?
Well, what you just said is not direct evidence. So it goes at most.
Is it unreasonable to infer animus with that evidence?
Without more to present a convincing mosaic, Okay, if you just have those remarks, I would say...
there are a lot of pieces in this mosaic.
Well, the only thing that I've heard so far is we've got statements, okay, which are not direct evidence.
We've got nasty ethnic slurs from the decision maker, we must assume on summary judgment, accelerating as the calendar moves towards the time of termination.
But what we don't have, okay, is we don't have to...
He doesn't say you're fired, you dirty Mexican.
That's right.
Is that what it would take to be direct evidence in your view?
Yes. You'd have to reference the adverse termination decision, wouldn't you? Okay. I mean, that's what makes it a rare instance.
This is one of those cases where we need to get away, in my view, from the indirect-direct dichotomy, and the mosaic system works better.
Okay.
But let me ask you about one other aspect of this case that I find very troubling. The evidence shows that Lass, the same guy that we have to assume used all these foul terms to describe Ortiz and other Hispanics, in the moment when he confronts him to fire him after returning from vacation, refuses to listen to Ortiz's response or explanation. And I'm really troubled by that. I understand it's a private company. There's no due process rights specifically at issue here. But we've got a man that we have to, I believe, at least on summary judgment, assume exhibits ethnic bias, who is essentially saying, I would say it's fair comment, don't confuse me with the facts.
Okay, first of all...
What's wrong with that analysis?
Okay, first of all, he never responded to the fact that he removed his name from 3 loads without permission to avoid taking a loss. So part of the conversation that he's talking about doesn't respond to all of the reasons that the company...
Well, apparently the meeting was ended pretty quickly because Mr. Lass didn't want to hear explanations about rates either, right?
But the point was the company had justification to terminate his employment because he did remove his name from the loads. And as far as cutting carrier rates, which is, I think, where you're going, look, we produced 17,000 loads. If it was happening... Where are the other instances?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I've been trying to say. It's very easy to say, oh, it was being done, okay? Unilaterally, it was being done.
How would that be documented? Would a change in rates show up in the final?
Absolutely. That's absolutely because we have the screenshots, okay, mm-hmm. from each load, mm-hmm. all right? And for the 6 loads in question, we have the screenshots.
For the 17,000 yes. loads, would the records that are kept at the end of each transaction reflect whether there had been a change
yes.
over the course of the transaction?
There should be. There would certainly be evidence through which they could sift. I mean, it may kill some neurons, to go back to something I said earlier today. It may kill some neurons to go through all of the evidence. But it was there. They never came up with specific instances. Your Honor, I understand your concern. I'm not here today to condone any statement that was made that was contrary to company policy. But I can tell you that those statements by themselves don't show...
You're talking about the ethnic slurs.
That's right.
Changing rates, there was no policy, was there?
They weren't. The policy was you can't cut the rate unilaterally.
Was there a written policy to that effect?
I don't believe it was
okay,
a written
policy.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Reese. Okay. We have to move on.
Again,
Ms. Temple,
for all the reasons we ask you to affirm, thank you.
With regard to the hostile work environment, your opponent says that this was not complained of to the EEOC.
Yes, that we did not make a separate hostile work environment claim in the district court and aren't raising it here.
Right.
The Krikova testified that when he found out that Ortiz had changed his name, removed his name from a load, he was asked, and did you believe it was wrong for Henry to have taken his name off of that load? Answer, no. And that's cited in our brief. It's on page 30 of his deposition. The rates were not shown on the computer screenshots of those 16,000 transactions. They were recorded in separate tour confirmation sheets. So you'd have to look at separate documents that weren't provided to determine whether rates were actually cut. Ortiz, in his declaration, also made the point that one of the customers that had this particular market pricing issue in June, Chevron, had a special policy with Werner to get market spot pricing relief if market prices were high. But there was no attempt by Krikova or anyone to take advantage of that policy or of any of the spot pricing that was available to get relief. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much.